Over the past half century, state hospitals have been closing down, leaving people with a variety of mental illnesses more limited options for finding inpatient mental health care. According to the nonprofit Treatment Advocacy Center, there are now fewer beds per capita in this country than there were in 1850. We're talking about the shortage of inpatient mental health care on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dominic Sisti is an assistant professor in medical ethics and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He's director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics and Behavioral Healthcare. He was recently quoted in an Atlantic piece titled, "Trump's Call for Mental Institutions Could Be Good." Dominic, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kate.
Well, so with the latest mass shooting in Florida, President Trump and others have argued that a relationship exists between mental illness and the surge in gun violence. From your vantage point, what's your assessment of these linkages, these claims?
So it is the case that untreated serious mental illness and individuals who have serious untreated mental illness will have a slight increase in the risk of violence. However, it's not a significant risk. And in fact, most individuals with serious mental illness are usually the ones who are victimized and not the perpetrators. Nonetheless, there are, the individual who committed the massacre in Parkland, Florida, may have been mentally ill. We don't know yet. And certainly individuals like James Holmes, the shooter in Aurora, Colorado, had schizophrenia. But then you have individuals like the shooter in the Vegas massacre. It's not clear to me he had a mental illness, and there were really no signs of him, other than him stockpiling guns, that he would commit that atrocity. So it's a linkage, but it's only a rather marginal one. Most of the violence that is perpetrated by individuals with mental illness is actually towards oneself, in the form of self-harm or suicide. And so to think that building psychiatric hospitals and placing individuals in those hospitals will prevent mass killing, I think is actually misguided.
Describe the state of inpatient mental health care today in America. Where is it at? What do we know?
So the state of inpatient mental health care is that there are a few state hospitals still remaining in states. Oftentimes, those state hospitals have a long waiting list for entry, and so you end up with a lot of individuals who are in need of serious long-term psychiatric care in acute hospital settings. Whether that be in a psychiatric ward in a large urban hospital, like at the University of Pennsylvania, or they might end up in jail, and they might end up languishing in jail, awaiting competency restoration at a state hospital, or they might end up getting treated in the jail, and stabilized. The other option, so that's the public side. Then the other option is the private side, where we do have private psychiatric hospitals. Many of these very high quality hospitals are private pay only, so they don't really take insurance, or if they do, they only, it's only as good as your insurance will cover in terms of the stay. So if you only get a month or two at most, then you're capped out and you have to start paying out of pocket. Now, if you have to pay out of pocket at one of these places, you're looking at between $20,000 and $30,000 on average per month. So they're generally out of reach for the majority of Americans.
And certainly completely out of reach if you would be an American on Medicaid, for instance.
Exactly.
So looking at the public side of mental health care, why is there this long waiting list to get into public institutions?
Well, so the state of long-term psychiatric care, again, is one where there's this scarcity of psychiatric bed capacity. So when you talk about psychiatric beds, we talk about treatment slots at in various settings. And in this setting, we're talking about long-term psychiatric care settings, such as psychiatric hospitals, state hospitals, farmstead-type settings, recovery communities. The number of these beds has declined dramatically over the past 60 years, from about a max, basically 1955 was our peak in terms of psychiatric bed capacity at around 400 to 500 beds per 100,000 individuals. Now we're down to about 21, 22 beds per 100,000. So it's been a 95% decline. And I would say that's the problem, is that through deinstitutionalization, we've closed many of our state hospitals with the hopes that individuals who would have normally found themselves in those hospitals, with the hopes that they would get treatment in the community. Many, many have. The problem, I believe, is that we've closed too many of those beds, and there's a certain population that would really require structured settings to recover, and they don't have access to those settings.
We're talking right now with Dominic Sisti. He is an assistant professor in medical ethics and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He directs the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics in Behavioral Healthcare. We're looking at the state of inpatient mental health care in America, the shortages of psychiatric beds across the country. You can join in the conversation. Your questions, your insights, your personal stories, 800-642-1234. Do you think mental health hospitals are necessary and an important part of mental health care? Have you or someone you know ever been institutionalized? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dominic, before we get any further into this conversation, let's discuss a little bit about the stigma around inpatient mental health care. We've heard the word sanitarium. We've heard the word asylums before. What type of baggage do we have about this type of care and how we associate institutions and institutionalizing people?
So, I mean, just that term institutionalizing people, I think, says a lot about how we think about this type of care. We wouldn't say we're institutionalizing a cancer patient for surgery. We would say we're hospitalizing a cancer patient for surgery because it's part of what is normal in terms of treatment of cancer. So I think a lot of the stigma that emerges out of these terms and out of our concepts really is fundamentally a reflection of the fact that we think of mental health care as something wholly different than medical care. And what I argue in my writing is that it's not. It's part of medical care. There's no real health without mental health. And we need to think about psychiatric hospitals as a point on a continuum of psychiatric care, much like we would with any other illness, where you have minor illnesses that might only require outpatient visits, maybe some, shorter term types of stays in hospitals for various ailments. And then you have things where, frankly, a person might need to be hospitalized for days, weeks, or months. That's what I think of when I think of a psychiatric hospital. It's the sort of endpoint on a continuum of care that is designed for the sickest individuals who need the most structure and intensive treatment. I wouldn't call it institutionalization. I would call it hospitalization. It's really designed to provide individuals the structure they need to begin or continue their recovery and hopefully get back into the community.
Dominic, what happened in 1955 that really changed perception and started the wave of closing of these hospitals?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a complex history, but there was a coalescence, I think, of a number of factors, including the advent of antipsychotic drugs that promised to allow individuals with psychotic symptoms to live in the community with their illnesses controlled by medication. There were a number of scandals exposing the horrible conditions in many of these psychiatric hospitals. And then there were state budget constraints that that drove economic concerns. All of these things happened against the backdrop of the civil rights movement, which really was transformed into a patient rights movement. So all these different factors came together that promoted the idea of living in the community for individuals with mental illness. President Kennedy's goal of creating a community-based mental health system.
We're talking right now with University of Pennsylvania's Dominic Sisti. He heads up the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics in Behavioral Healthcare. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Do you see a need for psychiatric hospitals? Let's discuss after this news. A federal study found that for Medicaid patients, mental illness conditions were two of the three causes of 30-day inpatient readmissions. Along with diabetes, these conditions resulted in approximately $839 million in hospital costs in a single year. We are exploring why there's a shortage of psychiatric beds and what can be done about it. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dominic Sisti is an assistant professor in medical ethics and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He stays with us. What questions do you have about inpatient mental health care in America? What can be done to solve the shortage? Would you support having a state hospital in your community? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Cameron, who's waiting in La Crosse. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning. Excellent topic today. I was just curious if Dominic had any insights on our system in terms of incentivizing private healthcare systems to open up more beds. For example, I live here in La Crosse. We've got a population of right around 110,000, roughly, and we've got a 22 to 24 bed inpatient psych unit. So it goes right along with your numbers that you said. So I was curious if there's any incentives or if there's other places, other countries that are putting more incentives to put more providers in the field.
Cameron, thanks for the call. Dominic, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Cameron. Great question. I think the answer is actually that there are incentives to cut beds in our system, not to increase beds. In fact, within the Medicaid law, there is a limit on the number of psychiatric beds private hospitals can actually have, and that's capped at 16 beds. Now, it sounds like the hospital in La Crosse there has a waiver under Wisconsin. You can get waivers from this rule. It's called the IMD exclusion, which limits the number of beds in various settings. Having to get a waiver, having to go through an application process and try to navigate all that costs time and money. If you want to be reimbursed by Medicaid, you have to do all that. So private companies really don't have the same incentive that that they have in other areas of medicine to develop services. Now, there was some discussion about streamlining the IMD rule so that some of these private companies would come into the space. And that was one idea that the Trump administration floated with regard to the opioid crisis to create beds for individuals who are recovering from addiction, but that's not happened yet. So the answer to your question is there really are no incentives, in fact, to expand. In fact, the incentives are more towards towards contraction. You asked about, the second part was about other countries with regard to inpatient beds. And believe it or not, deinstitutionalization really was a global phenomenon. Across all of the sort of industrialized countries, we see the same decline in psychiatric hospital beds. Now, what other nations have that many other nations have that we do not have is a single payer system and a more robust community care system that takes the or alleviates a bit of that burden from the inpatient side. So they all still struggle with the same problem of a lack of inpatient settings. But our problem is much more acute. We If you look at the number of beds that we have in relation to other countries, we're at the bottom of the list. So it is a crisis.
Dominic, when anti-psych drugs came on the market, were they intended to be this way as an alternative to having someone be in a hospital setting, that they were able to take these prescriptions, take these drugs, and be monitored at home, and that would circumvent the whole having to be in a hospital setting?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. And in fact, they actually succeeded in many ways. I mean, you know, many of these drugs do actually work, and individuals with psychotic symptoms who would have normally been in a hospital can live great lives in the community if their illness is controlled. So yeah, that was the idea, and in many ways it worked. The problem is there are individuals who either don't respond well to those drugs or have trouble staying compliant with their medication regimen. And those are the individuals that oftentimes will decompensate to a point where they need to be hospitalized.
But some would push back and argue in the hospitalized setting that patients are overly medicated, that they lose their rights, and that it is not a healthy mode of treatment to becoming self-sufficient again.
Yeah, and I think there's truth in all of that, actually. It is the case, I think, that individuals may, you know, perceive a loss of rights, but oftentimes if an individual is incapacitated and is unaware and unable to appreciate the state of their illness, the goal is to restore their rights, to basically get them back to an autonomous state where they can begin to engage in medical decision-making in a competent way. Moreover, individuals in psychiatric hospitals retain the right to refuse treatment, even if they're involuntarily committed. So it does take a number of sort of judicial steps, actually, to begin a process of treatment over objection. So it's not like one flew over the cuckoo's nest anymore. There are many different layers of regulation and oversight before an individual loses the right to refuse treatment. Now, in terms of whether it's a good treatment modality, again, I think it depends on the individual. And if it is a case where an individual can't live in the community safely, and they need structured care, they need intensive care, maybe one-on-one care, then the psychiatric hospital seems appropriate, but it wouldn't be appropriate for everyone.
Let's go to Tom now, who joins us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Many of the homeless people who can't keep jobs are mentally ill, and they, in the wintertime, they wind up in jails because we have no place to put them, and they could freeze to death out on the streets. I was wondering if maybe we could, in conjunction with the jails, design something where the mentally ill people, or you know, have a next door or something or other, have put psychiatrists and psychologists and have it some kind of a deal, an arrangement that way that we can help people, because a lot of people in jail need mental health too, and they're not getting the education or the mental health that they need.
Tom, thank you for the call. Dominic, go ahead.
Yeah, so on the homeless point, I mean, I think a key thing here is more housing, and in fact, more housing through a housing first model, which provides housing to individuals who may or may not be mentally ill with no questions asked. It just gets them into a domicile and they can live and begin their lives in recovery, hopefully. We need more programs that offer housing. In terms of the jail population, that's a big worry of mine. There are some jails that actually are beginning to reorient their services towards a model of psychiatric hospitals. So Cook County Jail, for example, there in Chicago. You know, Tom Dart, the sheriff of Cook County, thinks of his jail as a psychiatric hospital. So they're developing programming, education programs, mental health programs, and reentry programs, all based on the notion that individuals who are there as inmates are mentally ill and need medical care.
Dominic Sisti is with us. He's an assistant professor in medical ethics and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the state of inpatient mental health care in America. You can join the conversation with your questions, your insights, and your stories at 800-642-1234. Have you been on a waiting list before? Has a loved one been on a waiting list for inpatient mental health care? How did that go? How did you find services? And where are you today? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dominic, how have state budgets impacted the state of inpatient health care in America today? Are some states putting their priorities in state-run hospitals, others not? What does that shape up to be like?
So, yeah, state budgets have been declining now for decades, and that's been reflected not just in the state of psychiatric care, but in, you know, the state of education, in the state of roads and bridges and places where the infrastructure is run by the state. I mean, we see this time and again. The notion that a state will invest $200 million into a state-of-the-art psychiatric hospital is rather fanciful, unless the feds get involved. Now, there are some examples where the federal government came in and said these state hospitals aren't up to par. It's, you know, the Justice Department has, you know, taken the state's health departments to court, and judges and the courts have said you need to do better, in which case the legislature then, you know, perks up and then allocates the funds. So, you know, the lawsuits help, I think, in drawing attention to the state of the state hospitals, but they also oftentimes will be the conduit through which more money flows.
Let's go to John now in West Bend. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Good morning. I was heavily involved with psychology all throughout my life. And what I found out, I come from different culture, and what I found out that preventive measure for the captive audience that you have from age, let's say, 16 to age 18, an hour of poetry, of education, will prevent 99.99% of these emotional outbursts for the youngsters who go through emotional upheavals from the age, let's say, 4, 6, 8, up to age 18, and so on. So institutionally, if properly educated to manage these emotional upheavals and transformations, there are huge opportunities to prevent. An ounce of prevention is worth tons and tons and millions of dollars of cures.
John, thank you so much. It sounds like he's really saying we need to beef up the preventative aspect before we get to the need for inpatient care.
I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, having the outpatient capacity and access to early interventions is key, and that's another gap in our system. As much as I do agree with that, I still would argue that there will be a population that will require hospitalization at some point in their lives. But no, it's a very good point, and you know, prevention should be part of a comprehensive mental health care system.
What about group homes and small communities of people living and working together in a home? Do those models work, or are they also very costly?
So those models do work for the appropriate population. They are costly, but they do work. And I would actually categorize those kinds of models, if they're congregate living settings that have, you know, 20, 30 people, as what we discuss in our JAMA article on return to the asylum. These are various modalities that could work for various populations, like a farmstead, for example, where individuals are there, they're getting their treatment, but they're also, say, doing horticulture therapy or farming, learning skills, learning trades. Those are totally effective models for the right population. So, any number of, you know, I'm agnostic about the form of these places. I think they should be various and varied. They should, you know, reflect the needs of the population that they're trying to serve.
Let's go to James now in Platteville. Hi, James.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me on. I work as a EMS provider in Wisconsin and have found that many people enter this system through either by 911 ambulance call or coming to the emergency department. And it's pretty tough when they don't have insurance. It kind of seems like it falls on the county to pay for inpatient care for people. And you have to say the right words. You have to almost convince them that this person really needs a bed to get them one. Otherwise, they get released to a responsible party, which many times falls through, and the next day they're back in again. It's just tough that they don't have something easier or something in place for the people that are uninsured. People that have insurance, things go really well and fast.
James, thank you for that observation. And he's seeing that it reaches a crisis level, and then there have to be a number of steps implemented right away.
Yeah, and I think James is right that, you know, these individuals will present in the ER time and again. And that's it's not helpful to the individual, and their symptoms may progress and they may continue to decompensate, but it's very expensive. And if we had hospitals in place that could treat these individuals the right way initially and not have the individual go through the revolving door multiple times, we'd save money and people will be better off. So I agree with his observation.
So he's a paramedic. He sees it at his level. A lot of people perhaps working in the helping areas, paramedics, triage nurses, a myriad of different people may be seeing the need out there and seeing that there is perhaps not a single place to turn to.
That's right. And most of my colleagues at Penn who I discuss this topic with agree that we need more psychiatric spaces for individuals who are seriously mentally ill and appear in the emergency room or are basically languishing on some of our inpatient units. It's not the most effective way to use our resources, and the individuals who are there are not getting the best care in the right setting. And they could, you know, do much better in a psychiatric setting that's designed to enhance their recovery. And a floor of a hospital is exactly the opposite of that.
President Trump said last week that we need more mental hospitals in order to address gun violence and mass shootings in America. We're exploring what that would mean and how a shortage came to be in the first place with Dominic Sisti of the University of Pennsylvania. He's director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics in Behavioral Healthcare. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you know someone who suffers from serious mental health issues? Do you think a psychiatric institution would help or hurt them? Do you work in healthcare, and have you seen the need? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. Some mental health professionals argue that adding more psychiatric hospitals is not a fix, that patients remain unnecessarily institutionalized and segregated because community-based services and support are inadequately funded. We're looking at the issue from a number of perspectives with University of Pennsylvania's Dominic Sisti. He's an assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work with psychiatric patients or in a facility? What insights do you have on inpatient care? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Nancy now, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling as a founding member of the Dane County, the Wisconsin, and the National Alliances on Mental Illness. And I've been involved for 40 years as an advocate and a parent. And one of our problems in this country is that we don't seem to realize we're dealing with people who have serious brain disorders. So we know how to treat people, but we need a continuum of care, and we need easy access to community hospitals when somebody needs hospitalization for a brief period of time. But then we need to have really effective, PACT-like, community-based treatment programs where those with serious and persistent mental illness will be treated, but will be in a process of ongoing recovery over many, many years, if that's what's necessary. So we need a nation that understands, and we need discussions that are whole and inclusive and cohesive.
Nancy, thank you so much for the call. Dominic.
Yeah, I would agree completely with Nancy's point. I mean, her initial point was that mental illnesses are serious brain disorders, and in fact they are, and we should treat them as such. We should treat them as medical conditions that require medical care across a continuum, whether that's outpatient care, transitional inpatient care, or intermediate to long-term hospital care. So I argue that we need conceptual parity in the way we think about mental health and physical health, not simply insurance parity, but conceptual parity, thinking of them as the same thing. And in transitioning towards that way of thinking, hopefully our policies will follow, and we won't have exceptions like the IMD rule that carve out exceptions for mental health beds and limit things and distort the marketplace. And the other point that Nancy made is I think really, really critical, is that, you know, individuals need to have the support in the community to both begin and continue a life in recovery. Without those resources, individuals will fail in their recovery. And so we need community-based treatments that are robust and that support individuals across the range of their recovery.
You mentioned at the outset of the hour that many private hospitals, private programs for mental health care are very good at what they do. What could be done to make private hospitals more accessible to people of modest income?
You know, that's a huge question. The cost for these places are enormous, and unless we as a society decide that that's where we're going to invest our collective resources in scaling up some of these places or reimbursing more generously for these types of places, then we're going to continue to see this shortage of and this inability to access these places for individuals who don't have, you know, $30,000 a month to pay out to be hospitalized. And this isn't even about, you know, involuntary treatment of individuals who are dangerous or who are you know, not accepting of their illness. This is about actually individuals who want treatment, who are seeking out intensive inpatient treatment and simply can't get it. So, you know, unless we as a society decide it's time to start investing in these types of places instead of other things that maybe are extremely expensive but have lower, you know, sort of utility. Like, for example, I'm thinking in my head here of proton beam therapy for prostate cancer. We reimburse for that when the outcomes are equivocal, but we won't reimburse generously for inpatient psychiatric care. So it's about our priorities as a society and developing a healthcare budget that reflects the most effective ways of deploying our resources.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Emily now in Milwaukee. Hi, Emily.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I've worked in an inner city emergency department setting, also primary care. And what I have seen as a nurse practitioner is that we really do a disservice for our mentally ill. We have Rogers Memorial Hospital, and right now they're really in a budget crunch, and they're considering closing their emergency services, which really puts Milwaukee, which is a large metropolitan area, at a disservice of how do we treat our mentally ill. Now, when we think of someone who has a high blood pressure and diabetes and they end up with kidney failure, you know, we don't think anything different about putting them on dialysis, which is a very expensive treatment to keep them alive. You know, we need to start looking at mentally ill as the same way, that it's just we need to give them the proper treatment so they can live a good quality of life.
Emily, thanks for the call. Emily, a nurse practitioner there, seeing the dire need in a larger city like Milwaukee, Dominic.
Yeah, and Emily's analogy to kidney failure and dialysis is perfectly apt here. And it's kind of, you know, the theme of what I've been trying to say is that we should think about these conditions as medical conditions and offer the same range of services that we would to an individual with kidney failure or heart disease or whatever else.
Let's go to Alan in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. I just retired last September as a circuit court judge in Columbia County, and it was really appalling to me how many mentally ill people I had to send to prison, because that was really the only, I mean, it was demoralizing to me almost on a daily basis. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think that society has to be shown to them that treatment is primary in these situations. I can give you an example. One young man who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia came back to me asking for his guns back because now he was taking his medications, and I knew that schizophrenic, if they go off their meds, they're going to be a danger. And I said, you'll never get your guns back from me. And I said, I want your judgment to show that. And I think we ought to hold government where, you know, we always hear these people have fallen through the cracks. Somebody saw, somebody knew, somebody could have done something, and they didn't. Those people, if they had liability or if the government had liability, if they fell through the system, there might be a more comprehensive way to keep track of these people.
Alan, thank you so much for the call. Alan, a retired circuit court judge there, and saying he's demoralized, sending so many people with mental health issues to prison.
Yeah, that's not an uncommon sentiment among, you know, individuals in the judiciary and in you know, the police officers and others in law enforcement. They see it. They recognize that many of the individuals they're interacting with are mentally ill, and they're not standard criminals. They're not. It's not like they know what they knew what they were doing at the time. They might have committed some act of some minor nuisance or some violent assault, but they were clearly mentally ill, and these individuals will end up in jail. And oftentimes, if they're incapacitated, they'll be in jail for a long time awaiting capacity restoration treatment, which is the treatment they need to have before they can go in front of a judge. So in Pennsylvania, for example, you know, there's been a backlog of individuals who need capacity restoration. Some of these folks have been sitting in jail for over a year before trial. They haven't even been convicted of a crime. They've only been charged. And they can't go to trial because they still need the mental health treatment to become capacitated. So it is demoralizing. I could see that as a response. However, there are some bright spots, and there are mental health courts, diversion courts that are trying to work with this population to keep them out of jail, and new, you know, outpatient regimens to try to keep individuals who are at risk in the community.
Could there be more government accountability here, as Alan talked about? What would that look like?
Government accountability? Well, I mean, if you look at the state of our mental health system and our health system in general, I'm not sure what, you know, it's clear that our government has not really prioritized healthcare as a right. Rather, it's, I think, framed in terms of commodity. And so working from that premise, there's not much you can do in terms of holding the government accountable. This is how oftentimes free market healthcare systems will, you know, marginalize certain populations, individuals who don't have the means. Medicaid, you know, the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act was a great thing for this population. These individuals, you know, these are the individuals that really, I think, needed to be accounted for under Medicaid and have been to some degree. But, you know, with talk of Medicaid contraction and in some states work requirements, you know, it's hard to hold a government accountable that thinks those are good ideas.
In the last 15, 20 seconds we have with you, are there any bright spots around the country, any programs you see that might be a real turning point here to help inpatient mental health care in America?
Yeah, so there are these sort of smaller recovery colleges around the country, recovery centers that are modeled after the, you know, basically mimic the community so that they help individuals quickly reintegrate. And I'm thinking of one in Asheville, North Carolina. There's sort of scattered throughout the country. If we could look at those places as models and potentially scale them up, we would be in a good place.
Dominic, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That was Dominic Sisti, an assistant professor in medical ethics and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He directs the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics and Behavioral Healthcare. He was recently quoted in an Atlantic piece titled, "Trump's Call for Mental Institutions Could Be Good." This hour of the morning show was produced by Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network. Thank you.